Good afternoon. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. This is Nancy Spanas filling in for Marcia Mary Baker for October 24th, 2009. We are talking today about a crucial breakthrough in the perspective toward pulling together a four-power arrangement, which has been outlined by Lyndon LaRouche as the crucial international configuration required to get rid of this bankrupt monetary system that's leading us into a new dark age and bring us into an era of recovery. We are talking today in the aftermath of a significant visit which Lyndon LaRouche and his wife Helga LaRouche made to the island of Rhodes approximately 10 days ago, where they participated in a conference on the dialogue of civilizations with numerous international participants, including many Russians, people from China, people from India, and numerous other countries around the world. I don't know that there were any other, there were a few other Americans there actually. As well as Lyndon LaRouche. And in this was the first time that Mr. LaRouche has attended this conference, not the first time Mrs. LaRouche has been there. She's addressed the event before on behalf of the proposals for economic development and returning to an era of sovereign nation states in previous years. But this year, it had an incredibly strong impact because here we are in 2+ years after the crash of the world financial system and with a new president in the United States, and everything is getting qualitatively worse. Mrs. LaRouche indicated that last year while there was incredible upset about the collapse of the international financial and economic system, everybody had in the back of their mind, oh, Obama's coming in, something will happen. Well, now the bloom is off the rose. This is no longer the case. So this conference was extremely significant. Mr. LaRouche's speech has been picked up broadly in interviews and other ways in Russia. It's been picked up in India. And most likely it's been picked up in China as well, although we haven't monitored that directly. And as this was occurring, we noted another major crucial development toward as a stepping stone to the four-power agreement Mr. LaRouche has been talking about. This occurred in China during a visit of Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. A large package of bilateral agreements were signed October 13th, which is immediately after the Rhodes Conference. And I want to characterize what Mr. LaRouche had to say about these agreements and then get in to speak with our guests today. Our guests are two. We have Mary Birdman here in the studio. Hi, Mary.
Hello,
Nancy. Mary has worked for EIR for many, many years and been involved in traveling to China and discussing with and being in on discussions for the development of the Eurasian Land Bridge development project, which has been a cornerstone of the international reconstruction organizing from the LaRouche movement for nigh on 20 years, immediately after the fall of the wall in Germany approximately 20 years ago. And our second guest is Alicia Serratani. Hello, Alicia.
Hello.
Alicia is joining us from our offices of the LaRouche Youth Movement and LaRouche PAC in Purcellville, Virginia, where we are producing fantastic educational and videos, which are becoming a major factor in educating not only the elite, but the growing mass strike movement within the United States to demand the kinds of changes that would allow the United States to join in with Russians, Chinese, and Indians. But just briefly to indicate what Mr. LaRouche had to say about these developments of during the Chinese-Russian discussions of October 13th, Mr. LaRouche said, "What happened is that Russia and China, with Putin being key in this thing, with President Medvedev agreeing, is that they have agreed on long-term development contracts, which would be binational in certain projects within eastern Russia. This is a very interesting development. And what this means is that now you have a stepping stone toward what I've proposed as the four-power agreement to launch a new world financial, i.e. credit system. And this is extremely important. It's not all the way yet, but it is a step in that direction." So I think we might want to start, since I don't believe that the United States press has had much to say, if anything, about this visit of the Russian leadership to China to make these agreements, with Mary giving us an idea of the scope of the economic agreements that were made in Beijing.
Well, these were on several very, very critical areas, which include energy, but not so much the gas and oil agreements, which got the most play, are important, but are secondary to the key question of nuclear energy, on space, and one which is also extremely important, which is on high-speed rail. I must say, in terms of what you said about reaction in the United States, I've just in the last hour or so seen a couple of coverage in Newsweek and a few other publications, which does just to give it the credit it deserves, it simply gives an indication when something like this happens, it does have reverberations even in among the American press.
Why? Coverage
on China's high-speed rail other programs. On the high-speed rail, I'll go into that first because it is very interesting. They were an agreement put together that China would help Russia build three very important high-speed rail links. Russia has only one, which is between St. Petersburg and Moscow. China is on the verge of, it's building at this point 13,000 kilometers of high-speed rail, which will be ready in the next 5 years, which will give China more high-speed rail networks than the rest of the world put together. So they do, and they have taken technology which
now,
is,
when you say high-speed rail, what do you mean?
This is so-called conventional high-speed rail, but these are dedicated rail lines which can run up to 350 kilometers an hour, taking
right.
miles a kilometer is 1.7 miles. And even faster, the Chinese have actually developed a technology which can use conventional track as well as advanced track. You have this throughout Europe in the ICE in Germany, the TGV, the Très Grande Vitesse in France, Japan, the famous bullet train, where essentially you get on a train, it moves extremely fast, and these rail lines in China, for example, will reduce current travel between the major cities by down to like one quarter of what they are now or less. And the other question is that this can be used for freight, which in a country like China, with its absolutely enormous economy, I mean, this is 1.3, 1.4 billion people, is also extremely important. And obviously for Russia, with its vast territory, it would be extremely important to be able to use high-speed transport for freight as well. And this is part of the agreements. So essentially the Chinese, and this for China, as you must see, is also sort of a reversal in role, because they have, especially after 47, received a lot of technology from the then Soviet Union. They are now at a point where they can actually take some of this technology and take it also to Russia. this what the program in Russia was designed for under Vladimir Putin, that by 2030 they would achieve a number of critical infrastructure programs. On these rail projects are among them. What would be built now with the Chinese-Russian cooperation is one from Khabarovsk to Vladivostok on the Far East Coast, then from Moscow to Sochi, which is on the Black Sea and the site of the Winter Olympics, and then from Moscow to Nizhny Novgorod, which is the main sort of central Russian industrial city.
I understand it's the third largest city in Russia. That's really interesting.
And the main sort of central.
And we've never heard of it over here.
Well, yeah. It's... There's China's like that too. You go into the interior, and there's cities of 10 million people you supposedly never heard of. It's the huge interior of this area. It's quite a challenge. We can discuss that a bit more later. The other projects are the existing Qianwen nuclear power plant, which is in Yangyonggang, which is on the coast of China. In fact, we visited it, Mrs. LaRouche and I and others. Because this is also the eastern terminus of the so-called Euro-Asian's continental land bridge. This is the biggest nuclear project in China. There are others which are being built in cooperation with France and the United States, but this is the single biggest one. There are 2,000-megawatt reactors which are now working. There are another four planned.
Do I get this straight? On the rail projects, and you should break it and ask any questions you have too, Alicia, but just let me get it straight to people. On the rail projects, the technology is being supplied by the Chinese, but the actual project will be built by the Russians with their collaboration. In the nuclear project, the technology is from the Russians for the Chinese, is that?
Yes, essentially. Yeah. I mean, these things, there will be a meeting on the rail question between the Russian and the Chinese at the beginning of December to hammer things out. But yes, that is basically the idea. In fact, there was a commentary in the People's Daily saying we can supply the high-speed rail technology to Russia. They can supply us with nuclear technology. We also have high technology coal processing, which we can supply. So it becomes a transformation of an economic relationship which has been based on export of wood from Russia to China, export of gas and oil, which has only begun, Chinese export of pretty low-grade consumer goods to Russia. It's the potential for transforming it, this relationship, which is of critical importance to both nations. The other third agreement is on space. This was that the Russians are launching a probe to Phobos, which is one of the, moon of Mars. Mars. I guess maybe it's more than one.
Do you know, Alicia?
How many moons?
Phobos, Mars?
It's one of the moons. Anyway, maybe it's the only Martian moon. But this will carry a Chinese probe, which will be the first time the Chinese have done anything on this level, which will actually go to the moon surface and send back information and so forth to the Earth. This had to be postponed, I think mainly for, it was supposed to actually begin this year. It will have to be postponed for a year, which did cause some disappointment. But on the other hand, they've now signed an agreement. It definitely is going to go through. So you have here this potential for a transformation of relations between these two nations, which is part of the essential nature of what the LaRouche plan, LaRouche's idea of essentially applying the American system to take existing economies and change them, which can be done very rapidly as necessary.
I'll say one thing that LaRouche had also pointed out in reviewing this breakthrough was something very interesting. We had been warning for quite a long time about the alarm in China about the fact that between the Chinese and the Japanese, they hold the majority of, I think it's just under $1 trillion in U.S. treasuries. And you can imagine the Chinese watching the United States, watching the moves of Bernanke and Geithner and Obama, promise to cut the budgets, but really just devalue the dollar, you know, by the day. So we had been covering that. Now, one thing that happened in this breakthrough was that the Chinese essentially took their U.S. treasuries and have invested them in physical development, in these physical developments of Siberia and Eastern Eurasia. So they did something that the United States hasn't done, which is they've actually increased the value of the dollar by committing it to something that actually exists in physical reality, which is not where most U.S. dollars are right now. I don't know, Mary, if you have anything else on that, but that's one thing. I think that's one of the most unique. Well, not one of the most unique. That's a very unique part of the breakthrough that was made.
In terms of financing, I actually don't know exactly, but there is no question that this would involve, on both sides, a great deal of investment. Mm-hmm. In fact, in Russia, there's been also a discussion that they have to, in political fights on their own financial economic policy, that they basically have to start investing Russian capital in Russia. On the Chinese side, they not only hold the treasuries, they have over $2 trillion in exchange reserves, a large number, part of which is dollars. Mm-hmm. There is no question that anyone of China of any sense realizes that saving the American dollar from the British imperial financial policy, from Bernanke and Geithner, is in the absolute most fundamental interests of China. So that they are not only investing very heavily nationally and to some degree internationally, but this investment in Russia, I mean, China has been buying many commodities. Everyone is remarking on it. They are investing in a major mining project in Afghanistan, many projects in Africa. But this in Russia, I mean, this is on a level, on a scale, on a technological level, more advanced than any of these. And therefore, it gives to the whole Chinese, Russian, and also to the dollar system, the point LaRouche has made, that this type of investment changes the nature of their debt from the United States to it's real. It's an economic development. This is the essence of the American system.
Yes. In a sense, they've actually sort of changed the subject, because the crisis has been discussed purely in monetary terms this whole time. Everyone's been trapped into talking about the global financial collapse in terms of monetary terms, which doesn't get anybody anywhere. So what they've done was essentially changed the subject. They said that we're going to respond to the crisis in terms of we're going to say this is a physical economic crisis. And we're going to make the nature of our collaboration, and we're going to put our resources into the building up of our physical economy.
I think the way that Lynn put it in one discussion, Alicia, was in terms of going actually toward replacing finance with credit, right? That what you're talking about doing here is in, and you can say more about this if you wish, but in our, as I recall the back and forth, is you're talking about taking the principle that was established with the founding of the Bank of the United States, the finances of the United States, by Alexander Hamilton, and turning a debt into the basis of capital for economic development.
Right. Now, we have a long way to go here in the United States before we can do that. What LaRouche insists that we have to do is first take all of the existing debts we have today and hold it up to a Glass-Steagall standard.
Right.
Which means you say, well, what is this? It's like any bankruptcy. You say, well, what are your legitimate debts? What do you actually owe here? And then you realize one thing that LaRouche had said is that you realize just how small the United States economy actually is, mm-hmm. just how tiny it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, the real crisis, which is the lack of physical development here in the United States, the lack of skilled labor, we're operating at a technological level that is below the amount of people we actually are trying to support. Any commitment to the physical investment of the United States would have to come secondarily to the abolishment of the financial derivatives debts.
Right, right. Yeah, the idea of bankruptcy reorganization first is for the United States absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm.
Just what might seem to be a sidelight, but it might be interesting to people in terms of what the Chinese are doing, not only, I mean, this deal has a unique character because it is the collaboration with Russia in the direction of the four powers, but the but even, you know, some time ago, I remember being in the spring of 2001 at a conference in Germany where there was a Chinese representative, Russian representatives, and a discussion with Mr. LaRouche about the need to have a new Bretton Woods system, revamp the world financial system for economic development. And the Chinese representative at this, who wasn't official, but he was sort of speaking for a faction in the government there, just had his, was sort of upset because he felt that his, there were so many people in his government who were committed to collecting dollars,
mm-hmm,
as opposed to using those, mm-hmm, dollars in order to develop his country. But then, of course, on the other side, you have had, up until a recent period, a significant problem in the United States to be willing to export to China the high technology goods or machine tools, space methods, and so forth, things that that the neocons have run around and said are, give them the right to spy against us or something like that. We haven't been willing to have a technology transfer, mm-hmm, to China that they have been desperate for over, you know, decades, in which case their whole so-called dollar surplus, which everybody runs, all these jerky central bankers run around and make a big deal about, mm-hmm, wouldn't have been that significant at all, because it wouldn't have been a policy of using China as a runaway shop. It would be a policy of transferring technology for their economic development, which they are now, you know, taking their own steps toward. But in order to complete that, of course, as Mr. LaRouche has emphasized, this is a stepping stone. The United States itself also has to be involved if we are going to actually get out of the potential new dark age that a collapse of the whole dollar system would represent.
I just want to add on this question you brought up about Hamilton and the bank and the First National Bank of the U.S. and the point, one of the points Mr. LaRouche made, quite ironically but very interestingly, is of course what Hamilton was doing. The United States, the new government, had raised all kinds of money to fight the Revolutionary War. They then ended up with these debts, most of it internal, and the question was, okay, do the people, the creditors, were they going to demand that money back? And Hamilton basically said to them, look, you know you're not going to get it back. We can't possibly repay you. So either you extend these loans, in fact, lend us more, and we're going to build the nation, which, of course, is what they did. And this is the point now. I mean, given if we do not go to these kinds of development projects, and of course the role of the United States in these would be absolutely crucial, no one's going to get paid back. So we might as well go ahead with them. It's the only way out, with, of course, this reorganization, as Alicia said, which is so essential.
Mm-hmm. Another major point. Did you have anything you want to add at this point, Alicia? Or
no, not particularly.
So I thought that perhaps it would be useful at this point to look a little bit at the history of the development of the LaRouche movement input into what's going on in Russia and China. I mean, Lynn has made the point that this is not a Johnny-come-late. We're not Johnny-come-latelys in terms of what's going on right now. We have been proposing this kind of reorganization since the mid-1970s, in fact, but in particular around the land bridge development since the 1989 period. We can say quite honestly that we have played a catalytic role in the kind of economic development which is being discussed, and that, in fact, Lynn himself is the only person who understands how to put together a global credit system based upon that kind of economic development perspective, because, you know, most of these guys have two worlds in their head. They have the monetary world and the physical development world, and they may be a little bit, in countries like Russia and China, more attached to the economic development world than a lot of Americans who are into the consumer society. But nonetheless, they don't quite understand how to make a global system based upon credit for economic development, as Lynn has uniquely understood. But anyway, since we have Mary here, who's been involved over quite some time in developing the LaRouche influence in China and Russia, China in particular in this case, why don't you say a little about the interventions that we've made over this period?
Well, there were many. I'll start from 1980, well, basically 1988. I mean, I was living in Germany at the time as part of the LaRouche movement there. When the wall fell, the world opened up. Of course, before this, LaRouche had gone to Berlin, and astonishing, even his wife, who is German, said that the diversity between the Soviet, Eastern European economies cannot sustain themselves at the current level. Things are going to break down. Why don't we go ahead? Russia should allow essentially some kind of reunification of the two parts of Germany, they will help build Poland, and this will then go into Russia and the Soviet Union and provide for massive economic development. Now, everyone was astonished. This, of course, was October 1988. 1 year later, this was all happening, we saw this all happening. Now, remember that at this point, LaRouche was a political prisoner in the United States. And through this whole process, particularly with Helga Zepp LaRouche, his wife, playing a key role, that he was just from his jail cell, essentially, laying out the kind of economic policy in terms of the credit system, in terms of the infrastructure development, in terms of the also cultural and other relations that had to be built around this development perspective, that just helped essentially present an entirely revolutionary policy throughout Eurasia. We took this, I mean, it began as the idea of the productive triangle, where you would take the most advanced areas of Western Europe between Berlin, Paris, and Vienna, just put much more investment into that, realize new technological developments, as you did during the space program in the United States, and go east. We took this idea, and then, of course, the wall fell, and LaRouche said, Eurasia. That's my policy, Eurasia. Now, certain things were happening in terms of rail lines being built between China and Russia, China and Kazakhstan, which were also because of all these economic changes. But what we did is take this idea and we took it to Russia, Georgia, Armenia, China, the Baltic countries, Ukraine, essentially everywhere, and met with very, very high levels of interest, enthusiasm, with always the reaction that what we were bringing was something unique. One key example of that is that Helga Zeplerush, I and other colleagues participated in a conference in China in 1996 on the development of the Eurasian land bridge, which was seen as essentially, there had been several years of preparation for this conference in which we were very directly involved with input from Lynn, from Helga, and others into this whole concept. And at this conference, which... in one of the typical historic things, the Russians were not very prominent. They were, you know, in some other
phase at the time. Have actually been wars or near wars between China and Russia. This is not...
But Helga Zeplerush made this presentation in which she brought in the idea of the transport corridor, which you, Alicia, showed in her... off-the-cuff presentation October 19th, the new idea of nuclear energy, of building nuclear cities, and also this idea of cultural cooperation, creating a new renaissance. And in the final plenary, this is a big conference. I mean, this was, I don't know, several hundred people were there. This was noted that her presentation was unique, was on a different level from the others, and this kind of contribution was essential.
Let me interrupt for 1 second, because for those who are listening, just want to make it clear that we still have copies of a special report by Executive Intelligence Review on the Eurasian land bridge, which includes the major speeches from that conference, including Helga Zeplerush's speech, those of largely the Chinese, other Chinese participants, and then elaboration from other members of the Executive Intelligence Review staff on how this global global economic project, this grand project to be able to develop the interior of Eurasia away from just developing coastlines to bringing development to very, very poor people isolated from that technological development to the largest land area in the world. So you can call 800-278-3135 and talk to an EIR representative and still get that report. Probably they'll give you a discount on it since it's old, but it's old, but it's new, right? Because it's highly politically relevant, not as a blueprint, but as an inspiration point in the process that we see developing now. So go ahead.
Well, yeah, I won't go into much more detail on it. It's simply that several times LaRouche himself has been in Russia, made a number of very, very critical interventions there, including in front of the State Duma. Helga Zeplerush has been in China a number of times, and again, always presenting also this key warning on the financial crisis, which, among others, the president of the Russian Railroads, Yakunin, has noted, including earlier this year at the London School of Economics, but also in the Rhodes Conference. He was one of the leaders of the Rhodes Conference, is that LaRouche was that unique individual who really did warn us that this crisis was coming and said what we should do about it. So it's this combination of this unique warning, which was unique. No one else was saying that this crisis was going to come and the solution being presented at the same time. We held series of seminars, meetings also in Wiesbaden, these conferences in which we brought people from Russia, from India, from China, discussing relations, discussing economic development. Just one other key example I'll bring out is at the end of 1998, November 1988, at a time, it sort of reminds me because of what the LaRouche was saying about the Rhodes Conference and other discussions going on, again, where we were having one of these very fascinating discussions among the leaders of all these nations, that this was at the time when the then Chinese president, Jiang Zemin, went to Russia for one of their state visits. And this was unique. He also went to Novosibirsk and visited one of the science cities.
Can you explain what Novosibirsk is?
It's a major city in Siberia. It's, I think, the major city in Siberia. And he went to Akademigorok, which is one of these closed science cities, but very, very high-level science cities, which Russia, the Soviet Union, had developed, in which they made just phenomenal industrial, military, and other breakthroughs based on the Vernadsky science tradition, which I think Alicia could say a bit more about. But just very briefly, at this trip, Jiang Zemin made a speech about the importance of science in the relations between these two countries, that this was a beacon for all of mankind, and only with a scientific cooperation, and he noted the unique Russian role here, can this their relations and their economies be transformed. And Mr. LaRouche's reaction is, yes, this is exactly what I am talking about. This is the level on which we have to cooperate. This is what my Eurasian land bridge, my U.S. development policy is all about. So this was, again, another moment in which there was a recognition after much, much input from EIR, from LaRouche, from the Schiller Institute, that is, again, something that is now coming about again today, the level of the cooperation. Unfortunately, then you had Al Gore coming forward in the United States, George W. Bush, relations between China and their perception of what Mr. LaRouche was doing, particularly did not continue on this level. But again, this is one moment where you again saw the potential for the response to this very, very multifaceted intervention from the LaRouche movement internationally into this region of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have clearly a lot of material that reviews that whole history on the LaRouche Pub website. That's www.larouchepub.com. It's been a very intense process with Mr. LaRouche focusing, as Mary indicated, a lot on the scientific tradition of Russia and the Soviet Union, which is absolutely critical to world redevelopment. The academies of science have been a major area in Russia where people have come forward as interlocutors with Mr. LaRouche, developing the new metrics for measuring economic development. And this, over the recent period, Mr. LaRouche has indicated that there was sort of a turning away from an investment by Russian society in those academies of sciences. They were some more iced out of the actual decision-making in the Putin era, even while he was doing other things that were more in the direction of reasserting Russian sovereignty. There were compromises that tended to downgrade that. But every aspect of Mr. LaRouche's and EIR's intervention has been to strengthen that, because that is, as Mary indicated, one of the contributions to mankind as a whole that comes from Russia. Now, I'm also aware that at the LaRouche Youth Movement, I think our listeners should be, there has been considerable attention being paid to that Russian tradition as well to carry on the organizing work. Do you want to say something about that, Alicia?
Sure. I think just one point to make, as Mary, as you were discussing the history we've had with these regions and all the potential development projects that are just sort of waiting for the go-ahead to begin. That is the natural inclination of mankind, is to do this, is to develop. I mean, the point has been made recently in the Moon Mars discussion, this human spaceflight and Mars colonization project launched by LaRouche in the recent period. For instance, when NASA was started in the 1950s, it wasn't just to go to the moon, to land on the moon in 1969. It was to go to Mars. And so the natural inclination of mankind is is to do this. We could have done a lot of this, which is useful because it sort of puts in perspective what we're up against, the system of monetarism that has come most recently from the British Empire, the City of London, and its little satellites in Wall Street. So I just want to make that point. And then another very important aspect of this breakthrough is the role of the United States. And there have been many people in discussion with LaRouche who may be very much excited about his policies and agree with what he's outlining that needs to be done, but they'll disagree that the United States can change. And this is actually where the Vernadsky comes in, because Vernadsky, he wasn't just a leading biogeochemist in Russia. He was a major political player in Russia.
You want to say exactly when?
This was in the 1920s, I believe, the 1920s and the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And he had actually, in some of some biographical work, he wrote specifically, you know, should I put my science work down because the political situation calls me, or, you know, can I do both at once? And it was a real struggle for him. Well, the tradition that he came out of was the Russian Academy of Sciences, which was founded by Leibniz. It was Gottfried Leibniz who compelled the Russians to put together an Academy of Sciences, not just as some side job, but as something that would lead and direct the government of Russia as to what they needed to do with this huge landmass.
And this, of course, is one of the, we could call Leibniz the godfather of U.S.-Russian collaboration, right?
Yeah, absolutely, because think about the United States and Russia. We're both huge land masses. I mean, we represent huge land masses. The idea of a transcontinental railroad, that wasn't a coincidence. Dmitry Mendeleev came over to the United States, saw what Lincoln had done, and said, well, we're gonna do the same thing in Russia. And so he organized the Trans-Siberian Railroad in Russia. And so there's a history which defines the United States' role in a period of time like this, with these sorts of discussions and breakthroughs that went on between Russia and China, is that the United States uniquely has, not only have we discussed the intention to recognize this potential of mankind, but we came up with a constitution that creates the mechanism, i.e. Article 1, Section 8, the power to create sovereign credit. We came up with a mechanism to deliver on that intention. And that's what all these other nations are facing right now, who are saying, okay, well, these monetary, the reigning economic dogmas have failed us. We need to look back at the basics. Well, the best of us actually want to develop our territories, develop our people. We have an extraterrestrial imperative, but we're not going to be able to do it with this monetarist system. And then you look at the United States. We have that. We have had that, and that's why someone like LaRouche, who follows in the tradition of Leibniz. I mean, he has said explicitly that Leibniz has had one of the greatest impacts on his life. He was reading Leibniz at age 13 or 14, I think. Leibniz subsequently having an influence in places like Russia, you have LaRouche, who is in that tradition, who then has proposed these projects to these major powers because he is of that tradition. He's of the American tradition, and says, look, I'm going to come up with these proposals. I'm going to give you the specifics of these proposals, and I'm going to give you a way out of this coming dark age. But it's got to be a collaborative effort, because no one country is going to be able to do it on their own. So that's what I would say. It's that that tradition is, while it's unique to the United States because we have the Constitution and we have the culture, it's a little bit buried because of a certain degeneration. But it's there. You see it in the absolute revolt of the population against what Obama is doing, following these crazy Nazi austerity orders. There's a huge revolt in the United States population against that. That revolt is a cultural reflex that in fact politics is designed to serve the people, and the people have a certain mission, And it's not just to stay here on Earth. It's not just to sign up for some political party. It's actually to develop the entire universe. Now, we've been able to accomplish that in the United States. Other nations have been able to do certain things, too. But we're in a period right now where if that mission, that potential of man is not recognized and realized, then we will go into a dark age. There are physical consequences for ignoring, you know, basic laws of the universe, and that is that we could go into a dark age if people aren't brought up to speed on these traditions, on the potential, and these sorts of things that are just sort of waiting in the wings to happen.
I would just add to that. If you take particularly this area of Northeast Asia, which is huge, incredibly mineral and other rich, but basically empty. There are, 40 million people who live in Siberia. 6 million live on the east coast of Russia. It is empty. There are, and it is actually deteriorating economically and has been. It's losing people, everything else. This could be rapidly transformed by the kind of infrastructure projects. But simply if you, and given the overall collapse in population, industrial production, et cetera, if you look at this region as only one example, it makes even more apparent this idea that the Obama administration is putting forward as our jobless recovery. There is so much work to be done to develop this region. And if you take about this idea of working in these huge areas, you are facing all kinds of extreme conditions, cold, distance, whatever. This is coherent. It's not the same challenges as going to space, but these kinds of projects will force all kinds of technological developments like the moonshot did. But it also just brings out all the more, we need every single human being to develop this planet, to develop space. And this idea of the jobless recovery, which the Obama administration is lying to everyone about, is all the worse for this.
I'm wondering if you want to say more, Alicia, on any of the specific forays that members of the LaRouche movement have made with the people in the Vernadsky, working on the Vernadsky tradition in Eastern Europe or Russia?
You want to be more specific?
Yeah.
Well,
do I want to be
more? Yeah, be more specific. What exactly?
I was thinking of the trips that we've made there with connecting with people who are trying to keep the Vernadsky tradition alive, and also the Vernadsky Museum in Russia itself.
Yeah, we've sent in both May and in August. There have been a couple of teams that have went over to Ukraine. The first in May, there was a conference that we were actually invited to, and then ended up actually pretty much running the entire show. And it became apparent that we don't take Vernadsky as sort of a nostalgic, what was explained to us when these teams came back is that oftentimes Vernadsky is looked at sort of as this nostalgic national figurehead that people don't know a whole lot about, but they know he's important.
Uh-huh.
There might be a couple streets named after him, a museum, et cetera. You know, but when we showed up in May and then again in August, our delegation from the United States knew far more about Vernadsky than we knew far more about Vernadsky than a lot of the native Ukrainians and other members attending the conference knew about. And you know, as it stands right now, we pretty much are we're advancing the quickest. The group of people we have here translating Vernadsky's works, we're advancing probably across the board and around the world. We're advancing the quickest on translating these and getting them, in a form publishable and in a form that you can actually work through.
Sort of a scientific renaissance project in itself, right?
Well, because you're finding all these incredible gems about Vernadsky. I mean, he was a contemporary of Einstein, but as LaRouche often, he cites Vladimir Vernadsky and Albert Einstein as not direct students, but ideological students, philosophical students of Bernard Riemann. And the what Einstein presents in terms of abolishing this absolute space and absolute time, Vernadsky picks up and sort of runs with it in a very, very provocative perspective on that puts man's existence right at the very center of the development of the universe. And because LaRouche is the best economist on the planet right now and has been for many, many years, and because our delegation showed up in Ukraine with the concern of, well, we have to rewrite the book here on physical economics, and we're going to use Vernadsky and his perspective of mankind and man's creative nature as a significant part of that. It was the intention driving our delegation that made us have a much greater depth of knowledge on Vernadsky, because what you find is that that's what Vernadsky was concerned was political change, a higher level of literacy, a higher level of education, the sciences, development, all these things. And so, you know, you can be from Ukraine or you can be from the United States and still not know anything about Franklin Roosevelt. It's you kind of get this sort of world citizen sense that if your intention, this universal citizen sense that you have this intention to develop the human race, you're going to go to the different nations and national cultures that have made advancements in these, but it's a real collaborative effort.
Right. I think also the thinking and learning about people like Vernadsky just underscores how much the whole idea of what it means to be a scientist has been degraded these days.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
Into, you know, someone who can play with computers or something faster than anybody else. I think we should come back in this last 9 minutes or so to, again, the whole four power concept, because we should make it very clear to our listening audience that, you know, we're not just talking about a set of great deals between two big countries whom we happen to like and who need a lot of economic aid and economic development, and we obviously, as people of goodwill, want them to get it. But LaRouche's concept here, in addition to this concept of replacing the monetarist system, which is killing us, literally, with a credit system, is a four-power agreement. And I think it would be worth us, again, going through the reasons for that. Either of you want to address that in particular?
Well, I'll just say there were three points that Mr. LaRouche had outlined as why it would be the four powers. And he said, I mean, first of all, you're going to need a power block strong enough.
Let's review who they are again.
Right. That's what I'm going through. The first is that you're going to need a power block strong enough to contend with the reigning financial oligarchical monetarist power on the planet today, which is interesting because then it puts in perspective how much of a grip this financial monetarist empire has on the leading governments of the United States. That you'd need the United States, Russia, China, and India to agree to say we're going to reorganize the global system. The second function of the four powers is that if you get an agreement between these four very different nations with very different orientations, cultures, histories, then you pretty much have, if you can get an agreement between these four, you can get anybody else on board for the most part. And I just forgot the third. So hopefully Mary remembers.
Well, I just think one of the things to bring up to think about is that this idea also has a great deal to do with what Franklin Roosevelt was doing at the end of what during and towards the end of World War II, before his tragic and untimely death in April of 45. But this idea of bringing together powers. Now, he did include Britain. This mm-hmm. was a wartime situation, so we understand why that. But his key powers were the United States, the then Soviet Union, Russia, and China. India was still a colony, but obviously this whole situation had to evolve.
Right.
But among the key things, certain principles, which is the idea of the national sovereignty. Basically, the United States would take the dollar out of the hands of the financial oligarchy. I mean, the dollar has become, it's the currency of the financial oligarchy. It's no longer the sovereign currency of the United States. Mm-hmm. The U.S. has to take it back. Exchange controls, other measures to make it a responsible currency in that these four nations and others can then make longer-term credit arrangements, because you know what your currency that you're investing now, not your currency, your credit, you know what it is essentially, you can essentially plan over 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, ensuring the development will ensure enable these countries to so-called repay these loans, but the real idea being that the economic relations among the nations would develop and essentially create an entirely new level of economic relations. But this has to be done based on national sovereignty. This has to mm-hmm. be reestablished. Mm-hmm. And this is the real fight. And the question is that these four nations, as Alicia said, are the ones. China has 1.4 billion. India has 1.1 billion. Russia has enormous resources, huge territory, and a very, very, it was one of the great victors of World War II. It played with the United States the key roles in the victory in World War II. And then, as you have described very clearly, very, very importantly, this unique, not only the economic power of the United States, which it has been coming out of World War II, was the greatest economic power the world had ever seen. This had happened before in American history. It can be really realized on the basis of these principles of the American credit system, the American Constitution. That is unique in history. And that is the, when these agreements on these principles are reestablished, mm-hmm. you have the basis for relations with Africa, with every other nation of the world.
Right.
I mean, it is the case, I was thinking about this the other day, that if you think of the winning coalition against fascism, you know, as Mary also indicated, you know, you had, and FDR was pulling together meetings with Stalin, and he included Chiang Kai-shek, you know, of China as a representative of China, whatever his political whatever was. And the this is, in fact, at the present time, a winning alliance against fascism. Because if the British imperial financial system, you know, really British Empire is another name for the world imperial monetarist system, is not defeated in the very, very short term by this coalition of sovereign nation states, you are going to have a fascist development on the world scale that will dwarf whatever Hitler was able to do. And, you know, FDR went a long way to creating the social basis for that to happen, this alliance to happen. It was unfortunately terribly compromised, almost treasonously so, as LaRouche puts it, by what Harry Truman did. And in that regard, there are many videos, a number of videos, a very recent one, also a couple previously, on the LaRouche PAC website, that's www.laRouchePAC.com, which go through the history of the fight over the Bretton Woods system, which is extremely enlightening to most Americans who don't know from Adam about what the fight was between Keynes and FDR, and what the fight for a sovereign currency actually represents. We're about to be cut off here, I think. I just want to thank you very much. We will have a significant attention to this whole issue of the development of a stepping stone to the Four Power Agreement and a new paper on Russia by Lyndon LaRouche that will appear in the upcoming Executive Intelligence Review. I encourage you all to either call 800-278-3135 and go to the website to subscribe, www.laRouchePub.com. This is the LaRouche Show for October 24th, 2009, and I think we are about to sign off.